Those of you that may be our guests today, we are in a series of conversations that I've entitled Happily Ever After. And it's kind of obvious from the pictures and from the title that we're talking about the subject of marriage. And each week we are looking at one big idea. And I keep saying this because I don't want you to lose sight of it. Every week we look at one, what I call, very simple idea. But there's a difference between simple and easy. And if you try to really apply what we're talking about, some of it's enormously difficult, and this morning is no exception to that. But to understand it is really quite simple. It's not difficult to do that. And this morning, I can summarize our conversation down into one very simple sentence. And that idea is this: to have any hope of living happily ever after, you have to watch your mouth and guard your heart. And those two are directly related. They're not kind of different ideas. They're very directly related. Now, there was a 4-year study that was done a while back by the Family Service Association of America that determined that by far and away, the most common presenting problem in marriage is poor communication. In fact, by a 2-to-1 ratio over anything else, the most prominent presenting problem in marriage, say that 3 times really quick, but the big deal is how well we can communicate with one another. See, it's not only important that we communicate, and you know, sometimes that goes by the wayside, doesn't it? In some marriages, sometimes people start to back off and back out, and before long, nobody's communicating with anybody. It's not only important that we communicate, it's important how we communicate with each other. We've talked about this several times in this series. There's an inherent risk in talking about the subject of marriage for several weeks in a row. That risk is some of you aren't married. And as a result of that, we've worked really hard at finding principles that can apply to broader relationships. This morning it's easy. All of us have communication issues. All of us struggle sometimes in the way we talk to one another. See, communications is the stuff of relationships, isn't it? I mean, that's what makes relationships of any kind tick and move forward. The better we communicate, the greater the possibility that we're going to have good, meaningful relationships. In fact, I think the difference between isolation and intimacy is the ability to communicate with each other. We intuitively know that. I mean, we know that our relationships are enhanced. We move closer to each other, no matter what relationship it is, if we communicate with each other and we communicate honestly with each other. When we do communicate well, things go better, we feel closer to each other, and we move toward intimacy. And when we don't communicate so well, then, or maybe even worse yet, we get frustrated and quit. Then things don't go so well, and we tend to drift further and further apart, and we move toward isolation. Intimacy is knowing another person as completely as possible. It is sharing your very soul with someone else. And so the fact is, we constantly are moving either toward intimacy or toward isolation. There really isn't a lot of middle ground. There's no neutral that we can stay in for long periods of time. We're either moving closer or we're moving farther apart. And we were never designed for isolation. That's not how God made us. Do you remember what God said to Adam after he made this guy? I mean, it's this perfect creature that he made exactly the way he wanted him. And when he got done, he looked at him and he said, "There's something about you that's not good. It's not good that you live alone." We have never been designed for isolation. We have always been made for relationship and for intimate relationships with each other. That's why God is so concerned with about our communication. That's why the Scriptures has so much to say about how we communicate with each other. That's why communication is so critical at every stage and at every level of marriage. See, marriage is all about two ever-changing people trying to get to know each other as well as possible so that they can share life's journey together. That's not an easy task. Communication is how we get to know each other. Communication is our self-revelation. It's how we open the door and let someone else in and let them get to know us. Communication is how you let one another influence each other. Have you ever wondered why it is that long-term married people start sounding alike, looking alike, thinking alike? I'll tell you why it is. It's because they've been engaged and communicated with each other and have grown intimate with each other. And after a period of time, they start to rub off on each other. And normally, that's a pretty good thing. If communication is such a big deal to relationships, if communication is so necessary for intimacy, if that's how God designed us to work best, then why is it so difficult? You know, I don't think any of us would sit here and say communication is easy. It can always be a struggle. So why is it so difficult? Well, when I answer that question, I run the risk of oversimplifying things. In fact, I don't run the risk, I just openly admit. I'm going to oversimplify things. There's certainly more to this than what I'm about to say, but this is the core of it. The reason it is so difficult is because we have a filter through which we process all communications. Now, we all have one. So what that means is, when we try to communicate, the person who's talking and the person who's listening both have a filter. And it's got to get through my filter, which implies the meaning, and then it's got to get your filter, which assumes the meaning. Sometimes that filter acts more like a shield than a filter, quite frankly. You know, sometimes what one person says comes up and it hits my filter and it makes no sense and it just kind of bounces off and no communication occurs. Other times, that message, it goes into my filter, but quite honestly, it gets distorted and skewed and bent when it goes through my filter. And then all of a sudden, I got one idea in my head and she's got another idea in her head, and boy, that's never happened in my house. And when that message gets distorted going through the filter, the shape of the idea gets changed, and what gets received and what gets imprinted on your brain is not what the other intended when they said it. And you say, well, Don, what are these filters all about? I mean, how do we get them and how do we bypass them? The answer to that is very easy. We get them by living, and you can't bypass them. How's that? I mean, you get them by living, by the way you process life, by the way you've grown up, by what you've been taught, by how you think. All those things and 1,000 more go into creating that filter through which you process absolutely everything that comes your way. And what makes communication so difficult is that those filters are, for the most part, made up primarily of our differences. Different backgrounds that shape how we understand things. Different experiences, different perspectives, different desires. And then we add to that all of the pride and selfishness that's kind of inherent in every one of us, and it's a wonder we communicate anything at all. And yet, that's what moves us toward intimacy. Now, some of you are sitting there thinking, well, if it's that difficult, maybe I'd just be better off if I said nothing. In fact, some of you have tried that. Some of you have tried that in your marriage. You've gotten frustrated, things weren't going the way you want, And so when communication goes poorly, you just kind of shut down and back out. There's a couple problems with that idea. First of all, if you refuse to communicate, intimacy and closeness just aren't possible. If you won't communicate with each other, intimacy cannot happen. Folks, in our world, intimacy is a euphemism for sex. But in truth, intimacy is a communications term. It's the ability to hear and to understand so that you really can come closer and understand someone's soul. Another reason why shutting down doesn't help you is because whether you talk or not, everyone communicates. Even if you never utter a word, you communicate. You say, well, why talk then? Well, because if you don't talk, then the other person has to understand what you're communicating by your facial expression and your body language. And how easy is it to confuse that? At least adding a few words to it might bring some clarity to it, right? And so we have to talk. We put words with our expressions to ensure that communication actually occurs. See, everyone communicates. If you're an average American, you will have 30 substantive communications today. 30 substantive conversations will occur in the span of your life today. If you're an average American, you'll spend 20% of your life talking. Some of you a little more, some a little less. But you'll spend about 20% of your life talking. Now, in an ideal world, that means you'd spend another 20% listening. If you were to write down all of the words that were spoken, the words that you speak would fill 53, in 1 year, would fill 53 1,000-page books. Now, don't write it down because you're not that interesting. I've said this before. The average man speaks 20,000 words in the course of a day. I'm just reporting here. So, you know, don't throw anything. The average woman speaks about 30,000 words a day. Please. The bottom line is we all know that women tend to communicate better than men. And they certainly at least communicate more than men. Thank you. But here's the way it works. When the guy comes home at night, he's used up his 20,000 words. She's got 10,000 to go. You know? That's the reason why when one man was asked, he said, doesn't it bother you when your wife always gets the last word? He says, no, I love it when she gets to it. Words and the power of communication are some of the most important tools that God has given to any of us. But because they are so powerful, because they have such an enormous effect, they have to be used carefully and they have to be used wisely. I read a story a while back about a man who went to the store and he bought a power saw. And he took it home and he opened the box and he took the little operating manual out of it and opened it up to the front page. And you know, it always has all these cautions in there, some of which just seem absolutely asinine. You know, don't drink the gas. Don't test it with your fingers, you know, all those kinds of things. But there were this list of cautions, and here's what it said, six of them. Number one, know your power tool. Number two, keep guards in place. Number three, be careful around children. Number four, store idle tool when not in use. Number five, don't overreach. Number six, never use in an explosive atmosphere. Pretty good advice for a chainsaw. See, if you don't believe that what you say is powerful, don't think about what you say. Think about the impact of someone else's words on you. Because that's precisely the impact you're having on other people. Most of us know this. James chapter 3 is one of the most pointed and powerful statements in all of Scripture about the power of the tongue. I'm not going to take the time to walk through verses 1 through 12. In fact, if you go to your neighborhood group, that's what you're going to do in your neighborhood group. But I want you to see kind of some of his introductory comments. Now, keep in mind, when James talks about the tongue, he's not talking about the physical organ. He's talking about our speech. He's talking about our words. He's talking about the use of our tongue. And in verse 3, he says, you know, we can make a large horse go wherever we want by means of a small bit in its mouth. You know, it always amazes me how a 100-pound jockey can steer a 2,000-pound horse by a bit under its tongue. You know, it almost makes no sense, and yet that's exactly what happens. And in the same way that bit sets the course and the direction for that horse, your words set the course of your life. The words you say, what you say and how you say them, literally set the direction for your life. The words that you use can either pull you together or they can repel you from each other. Either way, your speech will establish the direction for your life. Verse 4 goes on and it says, and a small rudder makes a huge ship turn wherever the pilot chooses to go, even though the winds are strong. He says, you understand, there's a greater rudder here, and when you control it, no matter what all of the external forces are, that rudder is going to establish the direction of that ship. The Queen Mary has a deck that is approximately 3 acres. The anchor that holds that ship weighs the equivalent of 10 automobiles. And yet that ship is steered by a relatively small rudder. Yet that's exactly the way our life works, isn't it? Just like a rudder directs a ship, your speech is the rudder of your life. It sets the direction. Because the tongue is so small and speaking is so natural, we tend to forget how important it is. And yet your speech is actually the controlling factor of your life. Just like the bit in a horse's mouth and the rudder on a ship sets the direction for those two things, your speech directs where you're going. If you want to know where you're headed, all you have to do is listen to your conversation. See, we think about what's important to us, don't we? We talk about what we think about. And at least every once in a while, most of us will attempt what we think about. So whatever you're focusing on, that's where you're headed. See, we shape our words, but our words also shape us, don't they? And so if you want to control your life, you must control what? Your tongue. You must control your speech. You say, well, what if my speech isn't controlled? What happens? Well, go to verse 5. And it says, and in the same way, the tongue is a small thing that makes grand speeches, but a tiny spark can set a great forest on fire. And the tongue is a flame of fire. Wow. It's a whole world of wickedness, corrupting your entire body. It can set your whole life on fire, for it is set on fire by hell itself. Every year, huge amounts of forest in the Pacific Northwest is burned up because someone was careless with the fire. And just like a careless camper can destroy an entire forest, a careless word can destroy an entire relationship and sometimes an entire life. How many marriages are destroyed by the way we talk to each other? How many children are scarred for life by the way we talk? How many careers have been cut short because we were going to say what's on our mind no matter what? We're going to make sure we got it out. How many relationships are devastated by what we say and how we say it? See, fire and words have a lot in common. Fire under control is a good thing, isn't it? Gives warmth, gives light, gives comfort. But fire out of control is destructive. See, the way you talk can set your whole life on fire. There's a chain reaction to your words. Everyone who hears them is affected by them and responds. And the way we talk has the power to build or to destroy. It has the power to hurt or to heal. Has the power to help or to hinder. We have to learn to control how we talk. To put it simply, you have to watch your mouth. And to do that, you have to guard your heart. Now, we all know that's much easier said than done, don't we? Because we've all failed at it at one time or another. See, something happens, we start out with the best of intentions and we're only going to say that which is helpful, and then someone says something or does something that sets off one of our triggers, and before you know it, your mouth is getting you in all kinds of trouble. James chapter 3, verse 7 says, people can tame all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and fish, but no one can tame the tongue. I'm just curious. Any of you tamed a fish lately? Not sure how you do that. You know, any of you that have a pet fish, bring it on a leash next Sunday. Show me how that's done. James seems to know. But he says, you know, you can tame all kinds of things, but no one can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil. It's full of deadly poison. Wow. There isn't a person here this morning that hasn't attempted at some point or another to control your tongue. And it failed. It just didn't happen. So what's the key? I mean, how do you go about doing this? I mean, understanding that we'll never do it perfectly. None of us will ever claim that we do. Understanding that we're still instructed to do it and are going to be held accountable for doing it. I mean, you all do realize, don't you, that Jesus said that we'll be held accountable for every idle word. I don't know about you, and I'm not sure I'm looking forward to that experience. Been a lot of idle words come out of my mouth at times. Yet, we're going to be held accountable. Understanding that your ability to control your tongue is directly related to your spiritual maturity. If that's the case, then what's the key? Jesus tells us. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus says, for whatever is in your heart determines what you say. Boy, don't lose sight of that one. That's a huge statement. Whatever is in your heart determines what you say. A good person produces good things from the treasury of a good heart. And an evil person produces evil things from the treasury of an evil heart. You know what he says? He says that your speech is a window into your soul. It is an infallible index into your heart. So when you think you have a mouth problem, the truth of the matter is you have a heart problem. We lose control of our tongue and our initial reaction is, where did that come from? That's not like me. Jesus looks at you and he says, that's exactly like you, and I'll tell you exactly where it came from. It came from your heart. For example, let me just pick one. One of the speech problems that we all deal with is criticism. But where do critical words come from? I mean, they don't just happen. They come from a heart that has several attitudinal problems in it. For example, pride. Pride says, I know better than you do. Why don't you recognize that and do it my way? Self-centeredness demands that you do it my way, and if you don't do it my way, I'm going to get angry with you. Criticism then flows out of jealousy. It's a heart that's not at peace with God for what He's given us. A heart that honestly doesn't recognize the blessings that God has already provided. And criticism is often accompanied by bragging and boasting that comes from a heart that's seeking to please people rather than to please God. That's nice. You know, the primary issues in all of our speech pathologies is pride. I mean, we keep talking about that insidious thing called pride. Do you have any idea how pride affects how we talk? Proverbs 13:8 teaches that a proud heart causes perverted speech. Psalm 10 says that the proud brag and curse and lie and threaten. Psalm 59 says that the proud speak filth and curses and lies. Romans 1, verse 29 says that those who gossip are proud and boastful. Psalm 73 says that the proud ridicule and speak only evil. That's the effect that pride has just on your speech. And if you try to control your tongue simply by exercising self-control, then folks, you're destined to fail. Now, should you control your tongue? Please. Should you exercise self-control? Absolutely. No question about it. But you will be unable to successfully control your tongue if you don't address the issues in your heart. You ever had a house with a termite problem? If you have, then how many of you would attack your termite problem by wandering around your house and squashing a few bugs that you see that come out into the light of day? Not a single one of you would say, that's enough. Because we all understand that down deep at the foundation of our house, there's more going on than meets the eye. And those things that kind of come out into the light, they're just a symptom of a greater problem that's there. And if you don't do something to address that greater problem, if you don't do something to address what's going on at the foundation, then you have no hope of dealing with your problem. Unless you call someone, ask them to come in and fumigate the foundation of your house, there's always going to be more termites coming from that source. See, the problem is not simply the few we see, it's all those that are at the foundation, destroying our foundation, that we don't see. And if we don't address that problem, we're doomed. The same thing's true of our speech. You know, the few problems that surface at this conversation or the next just belie what's really going on below the surface. Do I need to watch my mouth? Oh, absolutely I do. But I also better guard my heart. Because there's a direct line correlation between what comes out of my mouth and what's going on in my heart. Simply trying to turn up the self-control is a little like trying to squash a few termites. Not a bad thing to do, it's just not everything you need to do. The key to controlling your tongue is ultimately to change your heart. That's the key. Now, in just a moment, I'm going to give you some principles that you can use to help move you from isolation to intimacy. Principles that you can use that will maximize the probability that you can live happily ever after. But before I do that, I want to identify a handful of speech habits. Things that kind of rear their head in us. They're fairly common, quite frankly, with us. If I can put it in these terms, I want to give you five termites that are eating away at your foundation. Number one is lying. Intimacy is defined as sharing the whole real self with another person. And when your relationship is built on lies, intimacy is impossible because the relationship is built on a fabrication. For some reason, you don't want the other person to know the real you. So what do? You project a different reality. You say that which leads people to a different conclusion. The Bible is filled with cautions and prohibitions about lying. It warns us about what happens. Number two is criticizing. Fault finding, if I may say. The Bible warns us about that one as well. James chapter 4, verse 11 says, "Don't speak evil against each other, my dear brothers and sisters." I mean, that's what criticism is. It's speaking evil against one another. I've already talked about this one a little bit. But we tend to criticize because it makes us feel superior. It makes us feel better about our place in life. You know, criticizing is easy. All you need is an opinion and a willingness to say it. I mean, there's no skill needed. What could be easier than to have an opinion and to say it? So we do. Criticizing is really dangerous because it's subtly contagious. The more you see wrong in one person, the more critical you become in all of life. Why is that? Because it comes from a critical spirit. Number three is intimidation and abuse. You ever just listen to the way people talk to each other? I mean, intimidation and abuse really betray a really sick, self-centered heart. You know, the person who uses his words or her words in a way that belittles people and intimidates them really do believe that they're more important than anyone else. And that you should be able to get anything you want from that person and use any verbal means that you need to get it. Have you ever watched a child wilt under the barrage of a parent or another adult? Or watch a spouse wilt, slink away after their husband or their wife unloaded on them? I almost hesitate to use this example. But it's the most recent one I've got. And trust me when I say this, I'm not saying anything about genders when I tell this story. This works both ways. I've seen it from men and I've seen it from women. But I watched an interchange the other day, and in this case it was a husband who did something that he thought was going to please his wife. And I was kind of on the periphery of this and watching it occur. And it obviously didn't please her, and so she just unloaded on this guy. And the best term I can think of is wilt. You know, I mean, he reacted just like a plant reacts when it doesn't get enough water. You know, all of a sudden everything starts to slump and droop, and he just kind of wilts away and slithers away. You know, there are a million and one ways in which that interchange could have been handled so much better. But it wasn't. Why? Well, I don't know either of them well enough that I can, and I'm not about to try to play amateur psychologist here, but I don't have to. I can tell you why. And that is because there's a hole in that other person's heart. And some need hasn't been met. Some prior experience is damaged. There's a damaged person who's fully convinced that what they need and what they want is so important that how they speak to and treat someone else justifies the end. In other words, there's a hole in your heart. Number four is complaining. Complaining. You know, complaining literally sucks the joy out of life and the life out of other people. The Bible simply says, in everything you do, stay away from complaining. That's pretty clear, isn't it? Stay away from it. Complaining is an expression of discontent. You remember the story of Israel? You know, Israel, God took Israel on a journey. God took Israel on a journey. I've been on a lot of journeys that God didn't take me on. The journey that God takes you on is always light years better than the one you take yourself on. And God took Israel on a journey. And when God takes you on a journey, He provides what you need, doesn't He? And so here's Israel. They're on a journey. God's giving them what they need day by day, moment by moment. And what are they doing? They're complaining. Things aren't how they imagine they should be. You know, complaining is fed by two very powerful forces, self-pity and self-righteousness. Self-pity says I'm helpless. Self-righteousness says I deserve better. You put those two together and complaining really says I'm better than you are, but I can't do anything about it. I'm a victim here, so I'll just complain. Complaining is normally directed at other people, but for the Christian, the complaining that is directed toward other people is always deflected toward God. We question His wisdom, we doubt His care, we forget His goodness, and so we complain. Number five is gossiping. You ever played telephone? You know that game where you sit in a big circle and one person starts off and they whisper something in somebody else's ear and they just pass it around. And the whole objective is to see how close the message is at the end to how it started. I've never played that game once in which it was even close. Because here's what happens. It gets whispered in somebody's ear and they think they may kind of understand, but they don't really, so they have to say something, right? And so they pass on something else that is not necessarily accurate, and it gets passed on from person to person until it comes back to the source. And somebody says, is this what you meant? Folks, that's exactly what happens in our lives at times. Gossip spreads private information about somebody for no good reason. Proverbs 16:28, gossip separates the best of friends. It does. It does. You know, the gossip is a person who will never tell a lie if they can do as much damage with the truth. There are more relationships that have been destroyed because of gossip than probably any of us would care to admit. And you say, well, Don, how do I know when I should tell people something? You know, the answer to that question, if you think about it, is really easy. And that is, if you don't need to tell them, don't. Wasn't that easy? I mean, if you don't have a reason that you have to tell them, don't make one up. Don't tell them. I have a basic rule of thumb. I wish I always followed it. I try. But I have a basic rule of thumb. If the person you want to tell is not part of the problem or is not part of the solution, then telling them is gossip. It's that simple. See, and every one of these five things, the reason these are important is because they keep you locked up over here in isolation. They keep you sitting over here, separated from other people. And the question is, what does it take? I mean, think about it. If you're standing over here in isolation and you're looking over here at the possibility of an intimate relationship and you want desperately to embrace it, the question is, what do you have to do? What allows you to take the steps? I'm not even talking about what the steps are yet. We'll talk about those in a moment. What allows you to take those steps? There are three things. The first one is truth. I mean, truth very simply says, I can feel safe with the message. What this person is saying, I understand to be an accurate message. That moves us a little bit, doesn't it? That allows us to take some steps toward intimacy with another person. See, the only reason that you would lie to someone is to get an unfair advantage. And how can you ever be intimate with someone who's trying to take advantage of you? So truth is critical in here. The secondly is trust. Trust says, I can feel safe with you. See, it's one thing to say, I trust this message, but it's another one to say, I trust you. That's far greater. Because I can trust what you're telling me here, and maybe not trust everything you're telling me, but when I can say, I trust you, then that really opens the door for us. Trust is earned by consistency over time. It's proving yourself time after time, year after year. Once that's seriously violated, trust is enormously difficult to get back. See, forgiveness can be immediate, can't it? Trust isn't. Trust has to be rebuilt. But the third thing that allows you to take those steps is transparency. Transparency says, I can feel safe being seen. Transparency is all about visibility. It's being able to see through and to see what's really behind. When I was a kid, I remember we had a piece of furniture in our house. And as I remember the story, which it's been a long time ago, so my memory may be a little faulty, but there was a piece of furniture we had, a table that got scarred. If my memory serves correctly, I did it. But I'm not 100% positive of that, but pretty near. And we came from a poor family. I mean, you scar a table, that table's not leaving. It's just got to be taken care of. And so my dad went down to the lumber yard, and the reason I remember that I think it was me caused it, I think I had to pay for it. And my dad bought a piece of veneer. You know what veneer is? Veneer is this really thin, hard stuff that you can glue onto the top of something, and when you glue it on top of it, all of the flaws are covered over. And that's exactly what happens in our lives. Sometimes we take this veneer and we put up this thin, really hard shield because we don't want anybody to see all of the flaws that exist below the surface. And how in the world are we ever going to share the real stuff if we're hiding the real stuff behind a veneer? Folks, if you're ever going to take the steps that lead to intimacy, then there has to be transparency. Veneer does a great job of hiding flaws and blemishes, but it sure doesn't promote intimacy. So how do you communicate in a way that promotes intimacy? Four things are going to come at you really quickly. Number one, think before you speak. I have rarely promoted intimacy with spontaneous outbursts. It just doesn't work well, does it? Proverbs 15, verse 28 says, the heart of the godly thinks carefully before speaking. The mouth of the wicked overflows with evil words. The picture there is very simple. It's the wicked guy who just opens his mouth and let whatever's going on come out. But the godly person is not just smart enough, he's godly enough to know that there are some things that go on in my mind that should never get uttered out of my mouth. They shouldn't have happened in my heart. And that means I got to deal with that. But above all, don't let them out of your mouth, because then you exacerbate the problem. Proverbs 12, verse 18. Some people make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise bring healing. You know, when you just let yourself say whatever's coming to mind, boy, you can say some hurtful stuff. But if you'll be careful and if you'll think before you speak, you can actually promote healing among people. Number two, you not only think before you speak, you build up when you speak. Build up when you speak. Ephesians 4:29 is simple. Don't use foul or abusive language. Don't let everything you say let everything you say be good and helpful, so that your words will be an encouragement to those who hear them. Have you ever wondered if you were to cut out everything that you said that wasn't good and helpful and wholesome? How many of your 20 or 30,000 words a day would go out the window? I mean, seriously, what would our speech look like if we restricted our speech to those things that were good and honorable We just made sure that we treated people right. Proverbs 15:1 says, a gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare. How many times have you inflamed a situation by what you said? A situation that was already bad enough, dangerous enough, and yet you were careless in your words, and the result was you inflamed it. A gentle answer deflects anger. It's harsh words that make people flare. Number three, listen as you speak. You know, you ever had one of those conversations where it was very clear that the person had something they wanted to say, they had an opinion they wanted to share, and it really didn't matter what you were saying? You know, that you might have a perfectly fine explanation, you might have something that would be helpful and bring light and clarity to it, but there was something on their mind and they wanted to say it, and with total disregard to what you had to say, it was clear they weren't listening because they had something they wanted to say. Proverbs 18, verse 13 says, spouting off before listening to the facts is both shameful and foolish. Proverbs 18, verse 2 says, fools have no interest in understanding. They only want to air their own opinion. That's a fool. That's not godly behavior. Number four, watch while you speak. Psalm 141, verse 3 says, take control of what I say, O Lord, and guard my lips. Take control of what I say. Guard my lips. Watch while you talk. Sometimes we just need to put a brake on, don't we? You know, things start rolling and you know, I mean, you've been there. You got something you want to say and you start saying it and it's coming out so easy, you just figure, well, I may as well keep going. And so we just kind of let them have it and we ignore the fact that we just absolutely devastated the person and perhaps destroyed the relationship. Now, folks, that's one thing to do to each other just as fellow believers in the body of Christ. That's bad enough. But when it's the person that you love the most, when it's your husband or your wife that you really want to live an intimate life with and understand at the core of their being, you're certainly not promoting it by just kind of ignoring what comes out of your mouth. You say, Donna, I've already blown it. What do I do? Two things. Number one, accept responsibility for your actions. Own it. Don't pass it off and act like it didn't happen. Don't hope they'll forget about it and act like it didn't happen. It happened. It's there. It's going to influence. See, that's the difficulty of speech, isn't it? I've not found a way yet to take those words that flow out of my mouth that I didn't want to really get out. I've never figured a way to stuff them back in. Once they're out there, aren't they? There's not a thing you can do about it except to own it and say, yes, that was me. I'm responsible for that. I will accept that responsibility. And then number two is to seek forgiveness and try to make it right. You know, there's a fascinating statement. I got to be done. But there's a fascinating statement in Matthew chapter 5, beginning in about verse 23. And Jesus says this. This isn't me. Jesus said, if you come to worship and you know that somebody has something against you, and this isn't just that it's something in your heart towards someone else. It's if you even know that someone has an issue with you, then he says, what you do is you leave your offering. Did you notice that one? Don't just get up and leave. Leave your offering. I may be taking it slightly out of context, but not badly. Leave your offering. Go take care of the issue with your brother and then come back and worship. You got to make it right. You have to go look at that person in the eye and don't just say, you know, I'm sorry. No. You look them in the eye and you say, listen, I did it. I have no excuse. This is mine. I was wrong. Will you please forgive me? There's a world of difference between an apology and asking somebody to forgive you. An apology is this generalized I'm sorry that we throw at people to cover over what we've done. But when you own what you have done and you look them in the eye and you say, listen, I can't undo this, but would you please forgive me? You move this into a whole nother realm. And when you do that, it's possible to restore relationships and to live happily ever after. Heavenly Father, thank you this morning. Thank you for the clarity of your word. I just hope and pray that I've not distorted it or messed it up. But it's your word that speaks clearly into our hearts. Father, I pray that all around this room this morning there are people who will take your word seriously. As truthfully as I can say it, what they do with mine, I don't care. But I pray that they would honor your word enough to listen carefully to it and to be obedient to it. And that you would change our hearts and our lives as a result of what you do in and through your word, to cause us to watch what we say and to guard what we think. We ask it all through Jesus Christ. Amen.